Part 3. Tempest. Ah, how shameless, the way these mortals blame the gods. From us alone, they say, come all their miseries. Yet, but they themselves, with their own reckless ways, compound their pains beyond their proper share. Homer. Chapter 37. Darrow. Cacophony. As the Archimedes approaches the asteroid that is said to hold the Republic's salvation, I fidget with Pax's grav bike key. Thrax's razor, bad lass, rests in my lap. I am thankful for both. One is a reminder to stay the path. The other is a tool to help me do so. The asteroid doesn't look like much. It is grey, oblong, and lies on an outer shoulder of the belt, mined long before the age of Ovidius.
"Well, we made it here in one piece,"
Cassius says, and sips his caff. His thermal is pulled tight up to his neck. A bruise peeks out and stretches to his right ear.
"Hard part's done."
"You've never had a conversation with Quicksilver," I say, and kick my feet up on the wall. He slugs me in the shoulder.
"Sorry."
I lower my feet. "You went quicker close," he says, "at least from what you've said. I thought you were his favourite." "True, but he can be tricky. Still no energy readings. Metal, yes, but this was a mining sector."
"Should I start to hail the asteroid?" he asks.
"If he is here, he's already seen us," I say.
"We have a stealth hull."
"Yes, one his company made. He doesn't create questions to which he doesn't have answers. My guess is if he's in there, he's been watching us for some time."
"I bet he's as horrified as I am about the state of the hull. My poor ship is falling to ruins. Honestly, between you and Severo, it's a wonder there's not literal shit in the halls."
"Sorry, we usually have janitors," I say.
"Really? He doesn't even flush. A life of privilege is no excuse for slovenliness."
He sets his caff aside and sprays the wall where my foot touched with cleaning solvent and wipes it down.
"You really must take pride in the things you own, Darrow."
We fall into silence as we creep closer to the asteroid. Occasional reports come up the hall from Ori, who helms the sensor station between the cockpit and the lounge. The only other sounds are the whispers of the engines and the tremble of Severo's music from the machine shop in the aft of the ship. With the asteroid only a half hour away, the moment of truth is at hand. Did we come all this way for nothing? All things considered, a 36-day journey went well. It may have been fraught with anxiety, but actual threats to the ship were scarce. The Rim has already emptied most of their strength from the belt to bolster the Dragon and Dust Armadas in their attack on Mars. Only a few of their hunting parties gave us pause. As for the fabled Obsidian Pirates, we saw not a one on our sensors.
That is not surprising, really. The belt is so large it feels like an existential threat to sanity if you try to comprehend the expanse its asteroids fill.
But fill is the wrong word. In the belt, asteroids float so far apart they are more like islands on a sea so vast only metaphors can help the human mind understand it. If you poured all the water from all the seas on all the worlds ever sailed by man into a giant ring and then dropped one grain of sand into it, that grain would not even represent Earth's size against the tremendous expanse of the belt. Of course, there is no celestial object out here so massive as Earth. Instead, there are tens of millions of asteroids in swirls, shoulders, clusters. Of those, only 2.5 million are larger than a kilometre in diameter. Few are inhabited. Fewer still are populated with anything larger than mining outposts or pirate hideouts. Those asteroids that host actual cities are so rare and estranged from civilization, they are precious. The last lamps before the abyssal dark of the gulf.
That light from those lamps was once white, the color of the Republic. Now their bulbs either grow raw blue, or they don't glow at all. Past those last outposts lies the Gulf, which once was the moat that separated the Dominion and the Republic. It seems abyssal, but its darkness is not endless. Beyond the Gulf lies the realm of shadow and dust, the gargantuan gas giants and the moons on which the golds of the Rim have made their homes for centuries. House Ra presides over that far-flung civilization from its seat on the volcanic moon of Io. There are asteroids out there, too, with cities of their own, like Priam in the Trojan cluster, or Agamemnon in the Greek cluster. Though these cities lie on Jupiter's orbital path, they are cloaked by the mystery of distance and obscured even further by the hermit-like nature of their inhabitants. Even I know very little about those cities, their peoples, their ways. Past Jupiter, of course, lie the orbital paths of Uranus, Saturn, Neptune, places I've never sailed, and places I probably never will. And beyond that, far, far beyond that, dwells lonely Pluto, where civilization ends. And then, eventually, the Kuiper Belt, where sparks of the society have flared occasionally against the edge of the true dark, but never for long. It feels strange to contemplate what life is like on those spheres. In the Belt, I feel as if I am already deep inside the realm of darkness, but those who dwell in the shadows of the giants would barely consider me on its threshold. The last time I was so far away from the sun was when I was sailing for Luna aboard the Morning Star. Now Lysander is sleeping in my old bed on the Morning Star, and I'm sleeping in his bed on the Archimedes. Strange, the twists of fate. It is scary out here, and not because of the Rim Golds or the Belt's fabled obsidian pirates. It feels like the sun, like life, has forgotten you, and you could just slip away into the dark without anyone ever knowing where or when you vanished. In some ways, it makes me doubt I'll ever see the god tree forests and frog-swaddled highlands of home again. I notice that dread and let it pass through me. Then Cassius throws me a live grenade made of anxiety. "What if Quicksilver's not in there?" he asks. "This Lyria girl sounds scurrilous indeed." He glances back to make sure Severo isn't behind us. "I mean, she stole your kids, man." He nods to Pax's key. "I'm no father, but that's not just something you sweep under the rug. I don't want to be a pessimist, but what if Virginia made up this fleet so you wouldn't go on a suicide charge only to get nabbed by the Ra trying to get home? You mean, what if she's just preying on my hope and lying to prevent the enemy from obtaining a political and propaganda weapon that could drive a stake through the heart of Mars?" I ask. "Namely, my head?" I sip my calf. "Then I'd say she's doing her job." "Shit." He leans back in his chair. "I wouldn't want to marry a sovereign." "I didn't. I married Virginia, and she married me. The Sovereign and the Reaper, they're the shadows that come with us." He mulls that over for a time. "So, if Quicksilver is not here, or if he is and he won't help?" "Worry is a spiral with death at its center, Cassius," I reply. I feel Ori smiling. Cassius rolls his eyes. "Worry is a spiral with... I mean, come on. You trying to outdo Stoneside?" I shrug. "I'm not as confident as I pretend to be, but how can you lead if you cannot walk? And how can you walk if you fear every step? Whenever I find myself doubting I've made the right decision, I force myself to examine our situation through the lens of the path to the veil. A portion of the book's 10th understanding comes to me often during these moments. Forgetting is essential to learning, just as exhaling is essential to breathing.
Breathe out, then in. Find the self, then lose it once again. Thus the path goes ever onward. Stilling myself, I breathe out the memories of past mistakes and doubts, and then breathe in fresh perspective. My worries might be founded in uncomfortable truths, but they are, according to Ori, born of an idle mind and an idle body. Worse, my worries only create more feelings of powerlessness. Rather than fretting about whether I've made the right choices, I instead focus on preparing for the next one, whatever that might be. I was just like the marcher, I realize now. Trash from the past, circling the drain. But I realized on the morning after we turned away from Mars that I faced a choice. I could look back and see the light of home shrinking day by day and miss its warmth more and more, or I could resist the urge to look. I resisted that morning and found strength in the resistance. That physical choice has since become a mental one. I have not looked back since, and I will not. Virginia has given me a mission. Come back with strength enough for one last chance to win this war. I am now an arrow shot by her bow. There was no downtime on this voyage. I learned from my enemy and aped Apollonius. I made a syllabus and divided it into three parts. Body, brain, heart. For my body, I train with Cassius 6 hours every day cycle. 3 after I wake, 3 before I sleep. My body is bruised, my muscles ache, my hands are blistered, and my ego is smashed every day. He is a fantastic classical swordsman, and whenever he puts me down, he says with a smile, "Steel sharpens steel." He is not wrong. In the chaos of the battlefields, I have grown sloppy, my confidence obese from success, while my enemies have studied how to beat me and the Willow Way. 36 times 6 is 216. Those are the hours we have put in. I feel the change already. I also now eat 10,000 calories a day. My mass is returning like the hair on my head. I've kept the beard. For some reason, it helps me to feel like I'm on a mission. My heart is nourished by the book I write and the book I read. I write to my son, like I did on the marcher, before I go to sleep. It grounds me in my past and keeps my head up, eyes on the future he'll have. I find the lessons in my losses, my grief, and hope I pass those on instead of the pain. And I read the path. Ori suffers me daily, but if she's annoyed at my litany of questions about the path or Athena, she hides it well. I think Ori's strength comes from her response to suffering. Unlike me, she was not given the easy way out. I was carved, given a physical chassis through which I could vent my rage on the worlds. Physically fragile, Ori had only one choice: make her heart strong, or the worlds would shatter her in every way. The brain division of the syllabus is dedicated to the data Virginia sent. 5 hours a day, I catch up on my enemy's successes. Atlas's are legion. His campaign on Luna, in destroying its food stores, was genius, as was his pacification of North America. He's moved on to South America now, and I try not to obsess. He's the most dangerous of them all. But fighting him is only part of the war. I read about Lysander and his nascent alliance with the Rim, as well as intelligence briefings on Rim and Dominion strengths, politics, personalities, industrial capabilities, and all the players of our drama. I learn of Lyria's past, of Ephraim and Volga, and how she volunteered to go with Far. That part disturbs me more than anything else. Far. Intelligence is sparse on the mysterious warlord and his Uskomani. Something is off, based on the reports I've read. His tactics on Mars had the flavor of special forces.
No shortage of disaffected spec ops on both sides running around these days, but it seems there may be more to this one. I need more intel. The tone of industry I have set personally has influenced the others. The Archimedes hums to a productive rhythm. Only Severo remains a discordant note. I'm jarred from my reflection on our journey as Cassius grabs my shoulder.
Is it just me? Or does that crater look like it's opening its mouth and spitting at us? He asks.
I think it is spitting. I grin at the strange craft pouring out of the hidden hangar that has opened in one of the asteroid's craters. The ships are angular and made of a mixture of pearly and transparent material. I've never seen any ships quite like them.
Cassius darkens.
There's no cockpits, he says. AI?
Maybe. More likely drones with a controller.
Mm-hmm. A high-pitched noise goes through the ship, and the lights flicker. A face appears over the comms projector. The man is beautiful, and in his early 50s. His eyes are rose quartz pink. He greets us with a smile.
Darrow of Lycos, you have a beard!
Mateo, I say in relief. You're not surprised to see me.
No, but always delighted.
His voice takes on an edge.
Our Spitfires will escort you in. Please don't bother with the controls, Al Bologna.
Just Bologna, Cassius says. Mateo warms to that.
Interesting. Darrow, I will see you soon.
He disappears, and I stand, grab Cassius's shoulders, and kiss his head. Now, the hard part, I say, and head to the back. He shouts after me.
Tell Severo to clean up his mess in the sink.
I go down the hall that leads from the cockpit, past the sensors, through the lounge, past the crew quarters and the chutes to the guns, past the quad of service rooms, down the ramp into the cargo bay, and to the door to the machine shop. It's sealed, and I knock. Severo doesn't answer, so I crack the door open. His screaming music almost knocks me backward. My friend is making knives. He is shirtless, tattooed, and staring deadpan at the edge of a huge cleaver. Sparks spew as he sharpens its edge. He glances up, sees me shouting at him, and goes back to his work. Severo does not want to be here. He came along because he had to. He knows the importance of our mission, but it's not made him better company. He has rules. He'll share the same room or a task with us if it's meal or ship-related. But he won't reminisce. He won't joke. Sometimes at dinners he'll listen to Ori play a tune, but most times he slinks back to the machine shop or to his quarters in the escape pod. I call his name a few times, but I've been in battles that made less racket than the music of the Aegean street scene. Greens never should have met obsidians, as far as I'm concerned. They call the musical style cacophony. I turn it off so the sharpening laser's shriek against the metal is all that's between us.
Working, he says,
but he turns off the sharpener. He wipes the sweat off his body with a rag and eats sunflower butter, his new addiction, from a jar with a spoon.
We had a rule, he says. Door was closed.
When you start following Cassius's rules, I'll follow yours. We're on his ship and you keep leaving messes in the sink. He grunts.
Ori did it. Messy for a pink.
If you're going to lie, at least put in some effort.
Anyway, we're here. I've just spoken to Mateo. They've opened up a hangar for us to land.
He tosses the rag up and divides it in two as it falls on the new blade.
Nice.
What's that one called?
Abomination.
He turns the cleaver. I scan the wall he's made his personal armory. So far, he's made a Lysander, a Lilith, an Atlas, and an Apollonius. I doubt it's healthy naming knives for people who have given him trauma, but we all process our own way.
Are you coming with? I ask.
He turns Abomination a few times.
I'm in the middle of a thought, It feels wrong to meet Quicksilver without him, but they've always been oil and water.
You still haven't given me an answer. Will you teach me how to make one of those on the way back?
He eyes me, walks toward me with abomination, slides it past my face, and turns his music back on with its tip. Cacophony rattles between us, and I take the hint.